Tom, thanks. It's good to see you again. Yes, I've been in Arizona since 2000, been at Arizona State since then, and was involved in the establishment of the Biodesign Institute and served as its founding director. Thank you. And that's a picture of, you're going to, if you haven't already seen it, that's an image of the Biodesign Institute over in the Tempe campus. Just a little bit of background. I grew up on a farm. I spent the first 20 years of my career working in agriculture. I was for a five-year stint with the DuPont Company in Wilmington, Delaware. While there, I helped them build their agricultural biotechnology group. And while there, I really began to learn about the potential for putting proteins into plants that cause the plants to have a new agricultural value, such as herbicide resistance, by introducing a gene that caused an enzyme to be produced that allowed the plant to tolerate an herbicide, or putting in a protein that's toxic to insects, so the and only insects, not to anything else, so you end up with a insect-resistant crop. So, coming along before I arrived at ASU, I'd been doing this crop improvement with a farmer as the focus. I'm not going to talk to you about that today. I'm going to talk about something else that we've been doing since I arrived at ASU that really hit the press last year, and perhaps you'll find it interesting. Let me start, though, with the history. I was at ASU in 2002, this was at a period of time, and I'm sorry, a little bit of the type is going off up here. This was right after the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center in New York and the Pentagon. And I would say prior to that, we as a society in the U.S. saw terrorism as something that was out there, but it hadn't jumped to the top of our agenda for funding. And it was right after those attacks in 9/11 that there was an anthrax outbreak, or anthrax, not an outbreak, an anthrax attack using anthrax spores in the Senate office building in Washington, D.C. And all of a sudden, the United States decided that they had to plow some money into finding ways to counteract these threats from terrorists. And in my case, I was interested in the bioterrorism. How might terrorists use germ warfare, essentially, to attack us? And we wrote a grant proposal we wrote our proposal in 2001. It was funded in 2002 by the U.S. Army. And essentially, we said, we've got a lot of expertise in manipulating the genome of plants so we can cause plants to produce a new protein. What if we use that skill set to make proteins that might be of value as a national strategic stockpile of either vaccines or therapeutics in case someday we're ever attacked by bioterrorists using germ warfare? And our goal was essentially see if we could come up with a new way of causing plants to produce high levels of proteins, either these vaccines or monoclonal antibodies. And we spent 5 years working on it, and one of the topics that we happened to be going after was Ebola, because we had read, like everybody else had, the Russians had revealed that prior to this time, when there was still a germ warfare program going in Russia, they had attempted to weaponize Ebola. Now, if we had this sort of class back, or this in Biotech University back in 2002, probably most people in the audience would never, ever have heard of Ebola. It's a very rare disease. It causes lethality in well over half of the people that it infects. Nobody had heard about it, but the military had. It was high on their list as potential threats. After 3 years, in our 2005 final report, we said, we have demonstrated that Ebola virus-specific humanized monoclonal antibodies can be produced using plant biotechnology. Now, why should you care about that? Well, I had This had gone along sort of under the radar. No one paid any attention to our reports. Really, other than a few other scientists like myself, few people read our papers on the subject until all of a sudden in 2014, I got a call from one of our colleagues in San Diego. He works with a little company called MAP Biopharmaceuticals, and Larry Zeitlin was the guy who called me. Kevin Whaley is the CEO there. They've both been adjunct faculty with us at ASU since we started funding this in 2002, and we worked together. And Larry said, hey, listen to the news. There's stuff about our therapeutic, ZMAP. Well, what is ZMAP? It is a cocktail, that is a mixture of three monoclonal antibodies. Now, some of you have probably seen pictures of the Ebola virus. It's sort of a thread tube-like thing. It rolls up. The outer part of that virus is covered with a protein called a glycoprotein. I'll try to make this very short, injected some of this killed Ebola virus into mice. The mice make antibodies against the surface of that virus. From those mice, we cloned out cells that were producing the antibodies and made what's called hybridomas. This is old technology. They got the Nobel Prize for this over 30 years ago. But you have a single cell that can produce a single antibody that because we use the Ebola as the way to trigger it in mice, it reacts with the surface of this virus. So we clone that out, and then you take the DNA out of those cells, mouse cells, and get the DNA for that codes for the antibody. It's now pretty routine stuff. I mean, almost a high school student could probably do this if they were in a good lab today, because it's very, very routine technology. But now, once you've got this gene, what we did that nobody had done before was engineer it so we could put it into a plant, so the plant would make the antibody, that specific antibody that attacks this virus protein. In fact, we took three different genes from three different mice, all of which encoded antibodies which attack at different points in the virus, and put those into plants. Well, anyway, Bloomberg broke this news, and some of you may remember this. We had two American missionaries working in Liberia, and like quite a few other health workers over there, they were infected by the Ebola virus. And they were about to die. And by circumstances, I won't bore you with all the details, it happened that two vials of these antibodies we'd made in tobacco plants were in Liberia, and they were given to these missionaries.
It was experimental. You knew it had never been tested on a human being. Did you have any hesitation, or did you figure it's the only shot I've got?
I was dying. I was actively dying. So we thought this drug is possibly going to help.
You were both a patient and a guinea pig.
I have gone from being physician to patient to lab rat.
After you took the ZMAP, did you start feeling better very quickly?
Actually, my body began to shake and shiver violently, and my breathing got worse.
And you remember that?
I remember the people around me praying over me.
This guy had Ebola for about 10 days. When the Ebola virus infects the body, it gradually increases in content in your circulation. So he was at a level, his body was almost shutting down because he had so much Ebola in the system. At that point, he got his first of three shots, intravenously, IV, about 3 grams of antibodies purified from a tobacco plant. No wonder he began to shake. I mean, that's just, pardon me, but one hell of a lot of foreign protein that's going into your bloodstream, and your bloodstream's going crazy. But it did bind up the virus.
But after that first hour, My breathing improved. The shaking stopped. After 2 or 3 hours of receiving the drug, I actually was able to get up and walk to the bathroom, something I had not done in more than a day and a half.
So, this was more than we ever anticipated. It essentially brought this guy, and now it's a number of other individuals, back from death. So what the antibody does is go into your bloodstream. It's injected into the bloodstream. Antibody gloms onto this virus. When antibody is bound to a circulating virus, your body takes it out of the circulation and gets rid of it. That's essentially the secret. This was a fascinating story. That was 60 Minutes. It was the last show for this wonderful reporter who had just died in an auto accident shortly before the 60 Minutes was presented. But anyway, the media was fascinated by it. And that 60 Minutes was just a little over a month ago. Prior to that, when the missionary story came out, we were visited here at ASU by Channel 2 in BBC. That's our big science show. This show was picked up by Nova. We had lots of coverage and all sorts of questions, and I know I'm going to run out of time, so I'll let you read them, but I'll just go on through it. Now, so a little bit of background. We started on this 20 years ago by saying we want to see if plants can manufacture pharmaceuticals. And the first thing that we did in a paper we published in 1992 was to take a gene from the hepatitis B virus and put that into tobacco. We did it by inserting the gene so it was stably incorporated into the nuclear chromosome of a tobacco plant, and the tobacco plant made that hepatitis B protein. We also did the same experiment by putting the gene into potatoes. Now, the reason, we never intended this to be an actual vaccine, but to show proof of concept, we wanted a genetically engineered potato because you can eat it raw. And we simply peeled those potatoes, human volunteers ate them, and then we took blood samples from the individuals, and essentially the ordinate on this graph is the amount of antibody these individuals developed over several weeks after eating one, two, or three doses of potatoes in here, and they mounted a very good immune response. So this said that this was proof of principle that all you have to do is put a new gene encoding a pharmaceutical protein into a plant, it assembles, it becomes functionally active, and you can immunize somebody with orally immunize somebody. Now, what we had found in these studies, going back from the 90s up to about 2001, we were always using transgenic plants in this period of time. Essentially, I was using the technology I'd learned at DuPont on how you make insect-resistant corn or herbicide-resistant soybeans, where you put a gene into the nucleus. It's very stable. It sits there. It's constant over generations. It works predictably all the time. In terms of pharmaceutical production, we had to start dealing with the regulatory affairs of vaccines. They have to be very uniform. Each dose has to be constant. It's just part of the thing. And we'd find that as we'd produce it in various plants, as the tissue aged, there'd be a change in the amount of vaccine, etc. So it became a regulatory hurdle. And we said about 2001, which happens to be when I got this money, when bioterrorism came in, we had just switched gears at that point in time. And we said, we want to find a faster and more uniform way of producing pharmaceuticals in plants. And to do that, we begin engineering plant viruses. So let's say this is not Ebola anymore. This is tobacco mosaic virus. Happens to be also a rod-shaped virus. But we would take the entire genome out of a plant virus, reassemble it, put in some genes that we want, and now and remove some of the important genes for the virus. And now it looks about the same in terms of the DNA, in terms of length, but instead of having viral genes in the middle of it, it has some of the genes that we want to cause a plant to produce. And then we infect the plant with this, now we say, reconstructed plant virus. And what we showed, this is, again, collaboration with our company in San Diego, MAP and ASU. By 2011, we had published two papers in PNAS. One was this antibody production in tobacco plants, and we showed, working with the U.S. Army, we showed that this was a therapeutic that worked in mice, and subsequently it works in monkeys, and we also produced a vaccine. Now, the general idea that we have for Ebola today, I'll jump ahead to the conclusion. We'd like to have a vaccine that's low cost, that's efficient, that could be used for, first of all, every healthcare worker in West Africa, but also the general population. But until we have everyone immunized, people are going to get sick, so we'd also like to have a therapeutic in the stockpile so we can use that. So we'd really like to develop both of these. So by 2000, that was published 2011, by 2009 we had all this going. We knew that we could create these engineered plant viruses. We knew that, and I won't bore you with all the details, but we had been engineering tobacco in such a way that it really works efficiently to produce proteins. We had done this antibody engineering, primarily MAP did all that, and we had collaboration among all these groups. But what we knew and what the military, who was interested in the stockpile, also recognized was, hey, guys, Arizona State University's got great facilities, but you can't manufacture. That's not our business. You got to have scale-up capability. So the DARPA, which is an arm of the U.S. military that does all the pioneering research work, started something called the Blue Angel Project, headed by Colonel Alan McGill, and I was fortunate to be part of their scientific advisory group. And they recognized that if bioterrorists come in with a new pathogen, we already have in place pretty good capacity in the U.S. to figure out what that pathogen is and get it up, make a drug, test it. But what we were limited by in the U.S., really for bio-threat, bioterrorism products, is large-scale manufacturing. Quite simply, we have good manufacturing in this country with Merck and lots of other big pharmaceutical companies, but there really isn't a strong incentive for these companies to justify to their stockholders that we want to produce a whole bunch of something that's going to go into a stockpile, it's going to be purchased by the government at the lowest price possible, it may never be used, it's not a very boring sell to your stockholders, so we need a capacity in the U.S. to do larger scale manufacturing. So what DARPA did was invest close to $1 million in three facilities. One of them is called Kentucky Bioprocessing. We've worked with them also for about 10 years, and two of their folks are adjunct faculty with us in the Biodesign Institute. Essentially, what they do is do scale-up. They grow tobacco in very large greenhouses. They can now produce, they can grow something like 2.5 million tobacco plants at one time. They use robots to move them around, to pick them up, to process them, to dip them into a virus solution. Once you infect these plants with a virus, it takes about 8 to 10 days for that virus to take over the plant. And essentially, the plant is starting to die at 10 days because it's got this severe, quote, viral infection. Actually, it's got a replicating virus, but the virus is not producing more virus. It's producing the proteins we want. So after about 8 to 10 days, those tobacco plants are chock full of whatever we have designed to fit into them. It's then ground up in what is called in pharmaceutical industry CGMP, good manufacturing practice, very strictly regulated controls. These controls work in plants. I can say that with confidence because of ZMAP. We were shooting into the veins of these missionaries 3 grams of purified protein. No alkaloids, there's no tobacco, there's no nothing else in there. It's 100% purified antibodies. Okay, jump up 2012, Tony Fauci, the director of the National Institutes of Health, went to a very unusual event. He took the airwaves and was describing a publication from MAP Biopharmaceuticals. And this was the monkey trials using ZMAP. In this case, 18 monkeys were infected with very high levels of Ebola virus. They were given our ZMAP preparation. All of them survived. And this was really the justification, the basis for the the treating the missionaries in Africa. Shortly after that, this was in September 2014, the Department of Health gave a big grant to MAP Biopharmaceuticals to make more of this protein. And so where are we today? This is Wall Street Journal, just a couple months ago now. The human clinical trials are now underway to do large-scale testing of ZMAP in Liberia. These have been very difficult clinical trials to plan and even more difficult to conduct. Is it ethical to take more of an untested, unregulated, unapproved drug and give it to black Africans, because they're primarily the ones who are suffering from the disease? Shouldn't somebody else share equally in this? Well, the problem is there's no way of testing this therapeutic on people unless you have a population that's sick. So there's been a whole bunch of ethical things. The way this trial is being conducted right now is to give everyone who enters the trial the highest possible standard of care, rehydration, everything else you can do. But one group is also going to get ZMAP. And so the comparison is being done that way. The trial just started. Don't know how it's going to turn out. We're all very, very hopeful. I mean, all the early indications have been strong, but right now everyone agrees ZMAP is the leading therapeutic for Ebola virus. With that, I'll just step back and sort of end this by saying, you can tell by looking at me, I have been in this business a long time. For me, this is sort of a capstone on a wonderful set of things that I've been lucky enough to collaborate in, to see a project that started on our lab bench over at ASU in Tempe finally get to a point that it saved lives has been fantastic. Thank you very much. Tom, I'll turn it back to you. Do you want to do any questions, or are we going to just...
We're going to do that coming up, Dr. Arnson. Thank you so much.
Sure. Question is, really, just a general, what is biotechnology? And let me refer to our institute, which we call the Biodesign Institute. Same general concept. We are trying to design improvements in therapeutics, in environmental remediation, in a whole variety of things, design solutions based upon biological principles. Essentially, biotechnology is the same sort of thing. We're using biological systems, cells, intact organisms, like plants, for example, and modifying them with the most current of genetic techniques that we have available so that we add a trait, or more often today, take away a trait. This is called gene silencing. It's a way in which you can modify the behavior, the properties in plants, the nutritional value, etc., by using very precise genetics to alter the way that plant or that organism behaves.
Must have been good, Tom, if you were taking pictures.
It was. Yeah, it was. That was especially good. Now, and Dr. Arnson and our next speaker as well will be taking time for not only a question and answer session here coming up, but also also one-on-one interviews outside. So be ready for that. Once again, we do have a malt box back there taking our audio feed. So if you'd like to draw from that, you're welcome to do that as well. Tim back there will help you, or I could help you as well. But there, as I said before, there is more than one side to this biotechnology story, which you as journalists have an obligation to cover. Michael Dimmock is the president of Roots of Change and is a national food movement thought leader. His interest in this grew out of his experiences on an 11,000-acre cattle ranch. And both of these gentlemen are again going to be available for interviews after their question and answer session right here. But first, Michael Dimmick. Michael, thank you for being here.
Good morning, everyone. How's everybody? Good? Good. All right. So that was a very interesting story. Happy to hear it. I'm going to talk about a little bit of a different topic. I'm going to talk about more about the food system and the application of genetic engineering within the food system. And the concerns, I'm trying to synthesize all the news and kind of the battle that's played out in the media and in the marketplace around genetic engineering and why folks like myself who work in food systems and on our focus on food system reform are concerned. And so just to describe my background so you'll know, because as a journalist you want to certainly know where I'm coming from. I run this organization, Roots of Change. We're based in California. We're created by foundations that have been working in sustainable food throughout the 80s and 90s, trying to create more biologically safe and healthy food systems. My background is actually working. I worked for an agribusiness company in Europe and in the Central Valley of California. McDonald's was my largest client, sold them $25 million worth of tomato paste a year. The company did, and I was part of that team. And we were, part of the big food system. After a few years, I left that and came back to California. And while I had been in Europe working for this California company, I saw a lot of interesting things emerging in Europe, including organic agriculture and what we call now local food systems agriculture, the focus on local and sustainable. And so started working in that field for many years. And
can I interrupt just a moment?
Yeah.
Would you get on the mic? We're recording this.
Oh, okay. So. Sorry about that. Yeah. Good. So anyway, in 2006, I went to work for this organization because I had been working on issues that were very much in line with its mission to create a sustainable food system in the United States by focusing on transforming the system in California. We see ourselves as a catalyst or a reagent. Do people know the difference between a catalyst and a reagent? Well, by definition, a catalyst is something that sparks a reaction, but the catalyst itself does not change as a result of that event. Whereas a reagent uses itself up and is transformed. We see ourselves as engaging in different activities that change us. We evolve quickly over time because the food movement is changing rapidly. But our real focus is helping the food movement to become more influential and change the system, and we're really interested in the kinds of policies in California and the United States that give farmers incentives to become more sustainable, to do better with their labor, to give retailers and other people incentives for improving the food that we're all eating. And so genetic engineering is part of the issue. It all begins with this. Do people know who those three gentlemen are? Can anybody name them? Who's on the left? Yeah.
Edison.
Tom Edison. Who's on the far right?
Henry Ford.
Who's in the middle? No one knows. That's Luther Burbank. Does anybody know who Luther Burbank is? He's the greatest plant breeder in the history of the United States. Lived in Santa Rosa, California, where I live. I have plants in my yard that were actually came out of his nursery in Sonoma County. Back in the day, this was in the teens. This picture was taken in Santa Rosa, California in the teens, when both the two great minds of industry at that time came to visit him because they considered him the most important person in the United States related to agriculture because he was the guy that started what has become known as industrial agriculture. He started massive plant breeding. It had never been done before, and so California's orchards and much of California agriculture in the Central Valley emerged because of his great work. And it's interesting because from that mindset, many of the problems that we face in the food system emerge. Does anybody know what that is? An assembly line, right? Now, what's the connection between that and the concerns? Well, in an assembly line, The goal to efficiency is to eliminate all diversity in the parts that you're using. That mindset of an efficiency through the elimination of diversity is really the core problem in the food system today. Because we have created an industrial food system and laid it over what is actually a biological system, the health and resilience of which depends on its diversity. So the reason that we have the problems we have emerging from monocultures, the pollution problems, the insect problems, the pest problems, the health problems that we have today in the food system, is because we've eliminated the diversity that that we have lived with through our evolutionary history. And therefore, we have all kinds of unintended consequences. The link here is that biotechnology is another tool to create efficiency. So it's fundamentally at odds with what we need to do in the food system, which is to work with diversity, foster diversity, and learn how to work with it in order to create resilience and health for human beings and the ecosystem. So it's interesting. The reason I'm bringing this up is because this isn't my viewpoint. This is the viewpoint of a very important report that was funded by the UN and published in 2001, the Millennium Ecosystem Report, which focused on the fact that the degradation of the Earth's ecosystems, the primary driver of that is agriculture. And it's not because agriculture is inherently bad, it's because the systems that we've developed have created the problems that we're facing today. And so the exciting thing that's going on that I see happening all around the United States and the world is this effort to reintegrate agriculture with biology. We call it biologically integrated farming systems. Big projects in California in the past, funded by the University of California at Davis and the legislature, have focused on this idea of biologically integrated agriculture, where you work with agriculture and natural systems in order to avoid the unintended consequences and impacts that we're facing today. And so just to finish with this picture, I mean, the underlying problems is we have a system that is a corn-based system, many of you from corn and soybean system, that are basically feeding animals from a monoculture, which causes all kinds of problems, both for the ecosystem and the animals and the humans that live in those ecosystems, but also we are basically reduced our diet to 5 crops, which is not really healthy for us. We need much more than that. And we're dependent completely on oil. The system is dependent on oil, and we all know that oil is not, in the long term, might be 100 years, might be 200, might be 300, but eventually we have to get onto a different energy system if we're going to be able to survive as a civilization and produce food. So the paradigm, the real issue here is a paradigm shift. The reason that we talk about humus versus hubris is this whole idea that hubris is the idea that there is great risk in feeling too comfortable with a certain viewpoint or a certain set of actions or beliefs, that you can, in fact, be brought down by that dedication. We feel that there is some hubris in this whole idea of genetic engineering being the silver bullet that's going to save us. We don't actually believe that. We believe that the better approach is what we would call an agroecological approach, which is more holistic, that might use many different tools, farming techniques, social activities, market activities, to ensure that we have health and resilience in the food system. And, you know, there are many problems associated have emerged that I think are important to talk about. When genetically modified organisms were introduced into food production, the goal was to make the lives of farmers better, which we think is a great goal, and we support that goal. We want to see the same thing. We believe that agriculture is integral to the future of this country, certainly to the state of California where I live, and it is imperative and incumbent upon us as citizens of this country to ensure that farmers have what they need to be successful. But what we know is that genetic engineering and genetically modified seeds have created huge problems for farmers. I was on a panel with something with the Farmers and Ranchers Alliance in Chicago about a year ago, and one of the farmers on that conventional hog farmer said to me that, in fact, he is really upset by the fact that he can't get non-GMO seeds where he lives anymore. It's incredibly hard for him to get them, which impinges upon his ability to make choices around what kinds of seeds he wants to grow in order to deliver to certain kinds of markets. So all of these things that are here listed are actually impediments or problems for farmers that have emerged from genetically engineered seeds. The other really important thing, and this is actually for us, I don't argue about the science because I'm not a scientist. I don't argue about that with scientists particularly. What I look at is what the trends are, what the media is talking about, what the markets are talking about. The fact that 2 weeks ago Hershey's, which is one of the most important chocolate making companies, decided not to use genetically modified ingredients in its products anymore. That's a really big thing. Why did they do that? They did that because the public is putting pressure on them. And they're feeling it through the retail outlets that are, in fact, carrying products that they sell to the public. So there's something going on in the public that's very important for us to watch. And so I'm very interested in why does the public worried about that? Well, there's this huge debate going on in science. Many of the seed companies will say, no, there's consensus. But just this week, two reports came out, one from the World Health Organization, which is now saying that glyphosate might, in fact, be what they're calling a probable carcinogenic. You know, I've been under the impression that was not the case. You know, you see these reports, but it's a report here and there and there. But now a major organization is now saying that. That's Monsanto, of course, is reacting vociferously. They're calling for a retraction. We'll see what happens. But no matter what, you have to say in the public mind and among policymakers, there's a debate still raging around the health of the products. That's a concern. The other really big important thing is that the ability to patent seeds is a huge thing. The ability to own seeds is a huge thing because it concentrates power. Food is the basis of life. If you can control seeds, you have amazing power to control lots of things, people, cultures, countries. So this country, the United States, was born on the proposition that no one should have that much power. We left Europe to form this country in order to release ourselves from the hegemony of concentrated power. So it is only natural that there would be lots of concern in this country around that principle being violated through the ownership of seeds. It's a very interesting concern. So you have all these labeling campaigns going on. Also, because one of the most important tenets in economics around markets is that information be available so that people can make informed choices. So that debate is really important right now around whether we're going to label or not, so that those who have concerns are able to actually act on their concerns. Whether they're right or wrong doesn't really matter at this point. What matters is that people have the right to have information. And over time, as information continues to come out, the debate will be settled in time. I believe that. It will come clear eventually. So the struggle is, how do we allow the principles in which this country was based to be fully manifest? Because it doesn't help industry, it doesn't help science when we have a struggle over information. It undermines the ability for us to believe corporations, believe government, and believe science. So it's important that we deal with it. And it's not going away, I don't think. I think it's pretty clear that the food movement is here to stay, and it's growing in power. One of the things that we do is work on legislation. You would not believe the number of bills in the state of California related to food systems, and it's not only in California. It's happening all over the country. So it's very important for us to realize that this shift that's going on, this activity where consumers and others are becoming deep and strong stakeholders in the future evolution of the food system is a permanent thing, and it will only get more powerful. It will not be stopped. So how do we work with that? That is the big challenge. And here's what I think. I think there are some paths forward. Because as I said, I personally actually think, because of the story we heard from Dr. Arnson, there are incredible opportunities with these tools. Incredible opportunities. They are tools. And it's actually tragic that we've gotten into the position that we're in around genetic engineering. And it happened, in my view, because we went to market too early. And we got stockholders and investors and many other people involved. And the crops that are out there are really crops, the vast majority of those crops are not in the food system, are not doing the kinds of things Dr. Arntzen talked about. What they're doing is allowing companies to sell more pesticides and other, mostly pesticides, and therefore the story around them is not a really good feel-good story like we just had around Ebola. So we think there's a way out. These are our suggestions. There should be the dynamic around the science is really worrisome, because if people don't believe scientists, who in the hell can we go to arbitrate the problems? It's a real disaster, in my view. I'm on the Ag Sustainability Institute Advisory Board at Davis, and I'm on the Food Law and Policy Advisory Board at UCLA. And one of the things that I'm constantly bringing is that we've got to figure out a way to get through this problem with science, because we need people, we need, as the public and as policymakers, to be able to go and find legitimate answers. One of the things that we think would really lower the heat around the battle and depolarize is to just let the labeling happen. If it happens, I mean, retailers are going to do it anyway. Whole Foods is doing it. We know from conversations we're having with people that other big, huge retailers are getting ready to do the same thing. It's going to happen. If the industry was smart, it would just say, let's do it. Let's get that battle out of the way and focus on other things. It's not that important, really. But it's become this polarizing battle that the media covers. So let's get behind that, we say. There are legitimate concerns on the part of organic farmers. It's a huge and growing market. They can be damaged by genetic drift. How are we going to indemnify them? How are we going to protect them? We think the genetic seed companies and the farmers that use those seeds should create some way to protect those farmers. It's only fair. Farmers, it's interesting, organic farmers basically pay a tax for doing more to protect their soil and things by having to be certified. That's already kind of an unfair disadvantage they have. Now they have this disadvantage too. Let's balance the scales a bit. Lower the competition and polarization by creating some sort of a system that would protect them from unintended exposure to drift. The other big thing, and we are really happy with the Mars Company. The Mars Company's done wonderful things. They will create genetically modified seeds or GMOs, and then they will make those patents basically publicly owned. They're not owned by a particular corporation and held for profit making. They're basically given over in order to support the commons, the development of all humankind. We think that's a very smart thing to do. It does it that way; they don't become the enemy, and it shows the positive side gets to be a feel good story. They've done a wonderful thing around that. We think others should think that way. The other big problem is this: the core problem here is that we've got to get back to polyculture. We've got to get back to polyculture and agriculture. I was just on Tuesday in California on a bunch of farm tours at farmers and ranchers who are reintroducing polycultures into their systems. And it's creating huge positive results for them. It's creating better soil, better water retention. All kinds of positive things are happening as a result of people moving back to polycultures in their agricultural systems. We think that to the extent that we can bring that back into the system, we're in good shape. And then obviously the last one, we think, if you want to have a feel-good story, don't just be focused on making pesticides more usable. These are the take-home messages for us. We think they will lower the debate, lower the heat around this issue that we're facing, and help everyone involved, no matter what kind of farmer, what kind of consumer you are, what kind of scientist you are, what kind of policymaker. So I'm going to end right there. Thanks.
If you would come up here, make yourself comfortable, and I'll try to be the I'll try to be the midpoint here, if you would. No, as you too, as well, Michael. So I'll have each of you pin this on and get a... Now, next thing we're going to do is the Q&A, the question and answer session. We have about a half hour to dedicate to this. And if you would, of course, make your questions clear and address them to either Dr. Aronson or to Michael Dimmock, and we'll have a session go a half hour. The one caveat is that we need to be vacating this room at 10:15. So we have about a half hour to do this, a little bit more than that. After we vacate this room, we can do one-on-one interviews with each of these gentlemen for the next half hour. We're going to take a break, and we're going to give you the chance to do these. During that time, I would ask that we allow the student journalists to get interviews in that case. For the working journalists, they're going to have another session. One of the breakout sessions, starting at 11, will be with these two gentlemen, so you'll have your chance at that time. So in the meantime, let's give the students a chance to get some time with them. With that, let's see, do you have that switch on, Michael?
I do.
Testing.
Great.
Is this thing working?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
These gentlemen are very technically savvy.
First time out.
So anyway, we can, if any questions from the, any questions from the room? Do I have one over here to my far right?
First of all, the cost of ZMapp, I can't tell you yet because it's a number of factors are going to go into it, including the volume of material that is ultimately purchased by somebody. So there's a price sensitivity. The first 1,000 doses are going to be more expensive than the first 1,000,000 doses that are out there. So, but the opportunity to use plants as a manufacturing system is what the military saw, and now a variety of other people are seeing, as a much lower cost way of producing antibodies than the traditional fermentation-based system using CHO cells, Chinese hamster ovary cells, that we use to make cancer drugs and things like that. As to the cost of the trial in Liberia, it's being funded by a combination of USAID and National Institute of Health funding sources. And they haven't revealed in public yet what they're going to spend on this. And I don't think it's a secret. It's just that they're trying to build in the costs as they're going along. One of the biggest variables that you find in patients suffering from Ebola is you need to understand the viral load, how much virus is circulating. And since we are still developing good diagnostic tools, especially tools that can be used in the field, in hospitals in Liberia, you got this variable in there of they're probably going to be using more than one simultaneously. They'll probably be shipping blood samples back to Europe. A whole bunch of costs that are a little bit hard to quantify at this time. But I'm guessing if it's like other drugs of this nature, there'll be follow-on periods of time. It's probably going to be in the range of $100,000 per patient to do the trials. I'm guessing.
Good question. Next. Yes, sir.
My name is Nate Mott. I'm a senior dual major in food science and communications. I can't say your name. I'm going to go to Mr. Dimmock. When you talk about polycultures and their use of resources, we know resources such as water as well as oil and other systems are rapidly decreasing. How does polyculture balance that when oftentimes the conversation with monoculture is a decreased use of water and decreased use of other inputs?
The way that I think that it improves the situation, particularly in California, Secretary of Agriculture Karen Ross came out recently and said that soil building is going to be the number one way to deal with drought in California. Soil building actually requires that you introduce more plants. One of the primary ways of doing that is by cover cropping, green manures, which introduces more
plants into a rotation often. The other thing that they're talking about is building a much more riparian corridors and hedgerows in order to introduce windbreaks because of the impacts around drought. Also, infiltration of water. These plants that have very deep roots that are perennials are really good for water infiltration. One of the biggest challenges that we have, both actually in the Midwest and in California, is the refilling of aquifers. So one of the primary ways to do that is deep taproot plants. So that's one of the things that they're beginning to utilize more greatly in California, particularly through these hedgerow systems and riparian corridors. We also know, obviously, that if you're interested in lowering pest loads, really good rotations which attract different kinds of bugs is a really good way to do that. So that obviously introduces more. So then you end up using less pesticide and potentially oil that's used to actually for the machinery that applies the pesticide. So there's all kinds of different ways, I think, when you introduce more. Because the thing that you were, what you're referring to when monocultures are described as efficient, going back to my analogy around, yes, in a short term, in a short time frame, on a yearly basis, maybe that is a fact. The question is, when you're talking about the food system and biological systems, you can't talk about 1 year. You can't talk about 10 years. You got to talk about decades and centuries. And eventually you have to talk about millennia, because we've been here a long time. So a food system has to be designed to last for as long as we expect humans to be here, not for short periods of time. And that's one of the large challenges that we have. We have to rethink how the food system operates so that we understand how to ensure that farmers 1,000 years from now can farm without the resource base being degraded.
Very good questions. Over here.
I'm just going to add a couple questions for you.
Yep. We're not. We're focused on right now. We're focused on the labeling question. Here's one of the challenges for media. We have a very complex problem here around genetic engineering, and we have a very difficult time taking those complex problems and putting them in short bites for the public to consume and actually understand. Therefore, the kind of work that we do is what I'm doing here today, trying to untangle the problem by talk about some principles, how we might get to some resolution. But the other really important thing is we're focused on the one thing that we're really backing is labeling. Because we think that if we allow the labeling to happen, we get one fight out of the way, we lower the temperature a little bit, people can breathe, maybe we get creative around the other problems associated with genetic engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful.
But, it's very, very appealing.
Yep.
Some, a lot of farmers that grow corn.
Yep.
Tennessee, in one field, they'll have two different hybrids because there'll
right.
be a low spot.
Right.
And one hybrid cannot handle the wet
right.
springtime.
Right.
The fall and the lower parts of it.
Right.
And so you have two different hybrids.
Right.
That basically just ensures food security.
Right. Do I think that the market would drop for genetic engineered crops
right.
if you labeled?
Right. Also, just kind of cause a different issue within the economics of it.
I actually think that the problem would be a lot less than people think. I mean, there are arguments that there would be, well, first of all, costs for labeling. The government is constantly, and the markets now are increasingly calling for different kinds of labels. So that's the cost of doing business, we think, to keep the citizens informed. The impacts on farmers, they're having impacts because We're talking about loss of markets. For instance, rice growers in California will not let genetically engineered rice in because Japan is their biggest market. So they cannot do it. They will not do it. And so, you know, you see things like that emerging around different crops. Also, hybrids are not the same as genetically engineered crops. I mean, yeah, hybrids don't, no one's complaining about hybrids that I'm seeing. People are complaining about genetic engineering in the very narrow focus right now around, I mean, there are some groups that are complaining about lots of things. What we're talking about with labeling is, let's just let people know, because I think there'll be a certain crowd that won't care. There'll be a certain crowd that may care, that already cares, and they're already trying to figure it out. And then there'll be a big group in the middle, and I think that big group in the middle is going to be impacted by the long-term debates and the other activities that are happening in the field. So I think that's how I would approach it if I was a manufacturer of food products that was buying ingredients that were genetically engineered. That's how I'd be thinking about it. But obviously, that's not what I do. So.
And I should have brought this up before. If you would introduce yourself and tell us where you're from.
Okay.
I know you're from Tennessee, but yeah. Tell us where you go to school.
I go to the University of Tennessee, and okay. I'm an agricultural communications major with a minor in food and agricultural business.
And right. what's your name?
There's
welcome.
A lady back there has had her hand up.
I apologize.
I'm Hannah Pop. I'm from Middle Tennessee State University. My major is in ag business and the concentration of communication is doubtful. My question is for Professor Onsen. If we've learned anything over the last 10 years, is that viruses are very adept at mutating and changing very, very quickly and crossing barriers very, very quickly. How well equipped are we right now at identifying and being able to combat those strains as they come apparent?
Well, we're certainly a lot better today than we were 10 years ago. There's been an enormous progress in identifying and responding to new pathogens. But I think the whole issue of viral mutation and change is being somewhat misrepresented in the press. We know that every year there's a new influenza virus that comes out, and the bird flu type. And that's really because the bird flu infects both birds, swines, and humans. As it moves from host to host, there's gene reshuffling. It's been hypothesized that this might happen with things like Ebola. Very unlikely, because we know that there are at least three strains of Ebola right now, but they've been around for a long period of time. There isn't the same evolutionary driving force on an Ebola-type virus to mutate. So it depends virus to virus. In terms of our ability to respond, however, we've got all sorts of molecular tools today to identify new viruses, identify their weak points, such as how we develop a therapeutic to hit them, etc.
Thank you. And also have one question for
us. Yes. Yes.
That are genetically modified.
Yes.
Because it was like a study, 95% of
yes.
the components are genetically modified.
Correct.
So as far as labeling goes, I just kind of want to pick your brain. How would you kind of go about labeling each component within like a bag of chips that could be genetically modified?
I think the best way would be to just say this product contains genetically modified organisms. That's what.
So a blanket statement, not a.
Right. I mean, I think you. I mean. The technology we have today, you could put a little mark, a little bug on it, and then people could get more detail online. There might be a way to do that. I think that'd be a good approach. But we know, I mean, Walter Robb from the co-CEO of Whole Foods was, you know, talking about the fact that they're going to do it. I mean, it's going to happen. So the question is, how is it going to happen? I'm not part of the conversations about how it's going to happen, but I would assume that probably best to create a system that just allows the people who are interested, because many will not be, those people who are interested can dig deeper. So that's how
I just comment on that, the food labeling issue? I've been on the scientific advisory board for PepsiCo for a number of years, and PepsiCo produces things like Quaker Oats, which they have labeled some things as not genetically modified. It's really a marketing decision, right? Because there are no genetically modified oats. Nobody puts any time into it, so there's no economic return. So it's an easy thing to label. But they've looked at it for all sorts of other things, such as chips, for example. And I think, and I'm not speaking for them, I'm just in general what I hear, the big food companies would be happy to have food labeling if it's nationally done. But to go state by state with each one having a different requirement so that that if you're going to sell a bag of chips in California, well, that's a big market, so you probably don't worry so much. But if you're trying to cover a variety of smaller states and each one has a different requirement, it's costly. And the other point is we don't have any system in the United States today to track the origin of a bag of corn that's going to go into chips. Our whole harvesting system is a farmer brings his whatever he's harvested or she's harvested into a granary. It goes into a big pool and it's sorted out. Now we do have the capacity to take samples of that and analyze to see what DNA is in it. So we could go back after the fact and say, oh, this train load of corn has some, and we could probably work out techniques to say how much genetically engineered material in here, but every step is going to cost you some money. And I would say, as a principle in the United States, we've had the principle of having a safe food supply and an economically feasible food supply. That's just driven our entire agricultural policy for the last 100 years. Everything that's talked about of layering something additional on top where you need to have marker some identification from field to bag of chips is somebody's got to pay for it. And in the end, it will be the consumer. And we have to ask, is that benefit worth the cost that we're going to put into it? How many people would gain value? Would it significantly, for example, improve your human health if you know that 2% of the oil in your bag of chips came from a soybean that was genetically modified? I'm not so certain those bag of chips are that healthful in the first place, but we've got to factor all these things in.
I'd like to just comment on that because I think it is a very important point about the cost of food. The estimates are where the average household in the United States is spending 8 to 10% of its income on food, which is the lowest in the world. We are blessed by the abundance. It's an incredible thing. The problem with that, there is a problem with that, and that is that the costs, the unintended consequences to the environment and to human health have basically been driven out of the actual cost of food. It's being picked up in other places. There's a lot of data on this. It's being picked up in the health system. It's being picked up by those who are having to clean up the problems in the water table or, for instance, in California with dust, problems we have in the valley. So there are costs associated. So the question is, how can we drive those costs back into the food? Because there are costs. The problem is that farmers get blamed and have to pay for most of those things when regulation comes down. We actually don't think that's fair. We think it's a public cost. The public is asking for cleaner water, better environment, healthier food. Okay, then the public should help pay for that. And if it's not going to come out of the actual retail cost, then it's got to come from somewhere else. So people are trying all kinds of interesting things. In California, we've been trying to pass a sweetened beverage tax. Pepsi doesn't like it. But it would generate $1.7 billion a year that we can then invest back in systems that pay farmers incentives for doing things. We think that's actually a good solution. The cost of food stays relatively low if you're not buying that product. If you're buying it, it costs more. Today in the paper, the Diné people of the Navajo have put a 2% tax on junk food in their tribal lands. That's generating $1 million a year. What are they doing? They're reinvesting it in healthy food for their folks. So there are all kinds of things that you can do within a culture to mitigate the impacts and the costs of food. But we're going to pay for it either way. So the question, the driving force behind what's going on in the food movement is we're trying to wake everybody up to the reality. Because we've been in a little bit of illusion. We've created a system that keeps us in illusion. So, actually going back to the label, wouldn't it be interesting? A part of me believes, because 95% of the products have genetically modified organisms in them, if we in fact label them, people would realize it. They'd come out of illusion. You actually, as a genetic engineering company, might gain from that because people would say, well, we're doing it anyway all the time. So it's a very interesting issue here. And it's really about control, and that's the thing that people are concerned about in the food movement. It's the ability of large corporations to control the debate. Going back to the labeling, it was tried to go to Congress many years ago. The reason that these fights are happening at the state level is you couldn't get any traction at the federal level. The Congress won't listen to it, won't talk about it, won't deal with the issue, won't pick up the bill. So people went to states where the public was most concerned.
Next one. Yes, sir.
My name is Connor Murphy, and I'm a journalism and political science civil major here at ASU. And I have a question for Mr. Dimmick about CPAP.
Yes.
So can you just specify clearly, I'm a little confused on exactly what rights that entails, if, say, a company like Monsanto has a patent on the seed and that drifts over to an independent farmer. What rights does that entail for Monsanto regarding ownership? What does that mean for the independent farmer? And what avenues does the farmer have to maybe reassert property rights of the farmer?
Right. Well, historically, there are many cases that, and I would say that this is one place where they might have been working some problems out, but there were several cases in which genetic drift or a farmer who did not buy Monsanto seed actually, in fact, ended up having genetic material from those seeds on their property and were, in fact, sued for that. And there were a long series of lawsuits and fights, and there was a kind of a pushback by groups of farmers who were angry at Monsanto around that because they didn't feel like it was fair. So I do know that those cases, they have seemed to not, I'm not reading about them, I'm not seeing them, so I think Monsanto has done a good job about not getting into those situations any longer because I think they took a real black eye around it. Because who in the heck wants to piss off the farmers when you're trying to sell them products, number one? So I think that has somewhat resolved. But the issue is this. It's actually an issue of principle that we are concerned about. And that is, genetically, seeds have evolved over millions of years. If you go into the genetic material and you change one, two, three different portions of that genetic material and then can claim it, we think there's a little bit of a ripoff around the commons there. Because that process of evolution that generated that plant began way before a company came in the last 30 or 40 years and added a few bits, made a few changes with an incredible technology. We think that there should be, because there's a huge common ownership of that plant, there should be some shared... that the corporations should not have so much control. Maybe it's a shorter term patent. Maybe there's a sharing of proceeds with public institutions, because one of the big problems we have in the universities now is that they get most of a lot of their funding around this from corporations rather than from the public. And that creates all kinds of perception problems and trust problems for the public around what kind of science is emerging from those institutions. There could be some ways to deal with this, we think, that would be creative, get the companies out of problems, make science more believable, and share the wealth from biological systems that have evolved over millions of years.
Let me respond a little bit, too. Since you're from ASU, you may know that anything that we do in our laboratory, we are under a federal obligation to patent it if there is utility in what we do. And that this goes back many decades from the understanding that if we don't provide a patent, we aren't going to be able to license our material. There's no commercial incentive for somebody to pick it up and spend the cost in product development. The purpose of a patent is to provide a period of exclusivity so you can spend money in getting that product into the marketplace so people can benefit. With regard to the patents. Plant variety protection patents have been around since the 40s. One reason that picture was that you so nicely showed of the auto industry, the electronic industry, and the agriculture industry pioneers coming together, I was at a time that they were really debating how to protect intellectual property. It was a major change in the U.S. And it led to the introduction of the Plant Variety Protection Act.
which has been widely accepted. When you buy an orange today or a grapefruit, you got that little sticker on it. Why do they bother? You know, that's costly to put one on every fruit. That's an identity marker to show that somebody has a plant variety protection on that item, and that there's a way of returning value back to the company and, in some cases, individuals who invested the money to make sure that that's available to you. But the controversy that we hear today, the Monsanto and others' controversy about patenting, came with the advent of biotechnology. Before that, plant variety patenting was based upon characteristics, the shape of the fruit, the color of the fruit, etc. But suddenly with biotechnology, we could do patenting based on composition, the molecular components of a plant. And that was new, and there was a court case, and it was solved by it wasn't related to plants, it was related to bacteria and pharmaceutical industry, but it was decided by the Supreme Court that yes, you can patent a new gene sequence if it does the important things that patents are meant to do. Provides utility, provides value to the consumer essentially, is novel, and can be adequately defined so that people can identify it. And that was the big change in patent law. And the companies that, like Monsanto, for example, and I have no ties with them whatsoever, they're investing hundreds of millions of dollars in every new crop variety, and our patent system, whether you like it or not, it is set up so that it rewards companies that invest in product development. That's why we have it. And I would say, the alternative is the third world. You bribe somebody to do something and you don't know where things are going.
I just want to point out, this is one of those moments when the story, the fineness of the story, I mean, where the challenge to the reporter rises up. Because I didn't say I was against patenting. What I talked about was a refinement of the patent system to share the wealth more equitably, given the fact that plants evolve over millions of years, and by changing two or three molecules in a sequence, claiming all the value from that, we think there's some issues around that. We think that that's not quite fair.
Just as a quick follow-up, when did ZMAP patent?
ZMAP will be covered by probably a dozen patents. The U.S. Army actually has the first patent on the sequence for the gene encoding the antibody. We've got, ASU has got patents on the virus that's used to cause the plant to do things. So all these are pooled. In the case of ZMAP, there's probably going to be a pooling, and we're talking about at ASU, just a donation of our patent into this, because the major buyer of this material is going to be governments, and et cetera. So I really don't see any profit potential in this.
Anna Lee, you have not had a chance to ask a question yet. Go ahead.
I have a question.
And if you would, I half introduced you. But
I'm Anna Lee Peek. I am a student at Maryville University. I'm also a farmer as well. We've been here for about an hour and 25 minutes now, and I kind of feel like for those who aren't really involved in the agriculture and the food industry, I mean, I feel like we already kind of started off biotechnology kind of on a negative note. But like as a consumer, I feel like we have more choices than ever as far as like the foods that we can buy. I mean, there are tons of, you know, heirloom and organic varieties if that's what you choose to buy. But as a farmer, my life is also better than it's ever been. I'm actually using less pesticides. They're safer, you know, et cetera. And so I understand like your drive to reform the food system, because I definitely think there are ways that we could really encourage people to eat healthier and less processed food, et cetera. But I don't really think that it's fair to blame that on GMOs. Because, I mean, GMOs are not any less healthier than the heirloom or the organic, et cetera. And I kind of feel like by saying, like, oh, 95% of foods have genetically modified materials, that kind of puts it down and makes it look like it's a less healthy and less inferior product. So, like, how does, you know, labeling GMOs create a better food system? That's what I'm kind of missing your connection there.
Well, first of all, I didn't bring up the 95%. Somebody else did.
Someone
back there brought that up. I will say that It comes down to principle. Economists argue that the best markets are the most informed markets. That's when markets work best. That's what the economists tell us. Right now, there's concern among certain groups of the population. It's not universal, but certain groups of the population would like to know if that product has that in it. So I'm going by principle, because the underlying part of the issue in the American food system, and the reason that we got into so much processed food and things like that, is because the American public lost touch with the food system. In the last 50 years, people don't know farmers. They don't know what farming's about. They really just took it for granted. We were so good. And I'll say, it was an incredible thing that what we did in this country. Industrialization created cheap calories. And that was what we needed during World War II and at the end of World War II. We needed more cheap calories. And we got them. We did a fabulous job. The problem is there are all kinds of unintended consequences. So the question is, how do we re-educate the American public around food? It's happening. It's in the media. That's why we're talking about this. So it's in line with that. It's a principle. I mean, principles are about the application across systems, not use it here and there. So if we're going to have a principle, let's have a principle. And the principle is transparency in the food system. We're for that.
Yes, open here. Can I just ask, are you getting is your question more about does labeling something as a GMO,
is it a waste of time?
Is
it a waste of time?
I think the key point is, should consumer preference drive the labeling patterns we have in our food? And I think the answer is in federal regulations. The Food and Drug Administration is assigned the responsibility in the U.S. of deciding what is or is not labeled. In the case of the dairy industry, the product I love is something called Muscle Milk, a little bottle. And right under the Muscle Milk, it says contains no milk. Now, why would they put that? Because the FDA requires them to. Milk is a highly regulated product. You take it back 20 years when bovine somatotropin came along. This is the stimulant given to cows so they produce more milk. There was a big push that any milk coming from cows treated with recombinant bovine somatotropin should be labeled. That milk should be labeled. The Food and Drug Administration, I'd say, in their wisdom, ruled against it for a couple of purposes. First of all, there was no detectable way you could tell non-BST treated milk from the cows that had. There's no molecular difference. So in their, in FDA's wisdom, they said, if there is no detectable molecular differences between these things, there's no health benefit to the public in labeling them. And furthermore, you could extrapolate it. If we really wanted to still require labeling in that case for consumer preference, you would have to trace every milk back to every dairy farmer's farm, and you have to have cameras or something to watch to see what they're doing 24 hours a day to be able to enforce anything like that. We all know it's just, I mean, that's folly. It's craziness. So it's really the Food and Drug Administration who decides this. And at least in that product, they have said, I don't care if the consumer really thinks they should know, we do not require it. So what's been the response of the food industry? Most of the bottles of milk we buy here in Arizona say we do not use recombinant DNA in our, or recombinant bovine somatotropin in our cattle. Now, I'm a cynic, and I just say most of these dairies are buying their milk all over, and they maybe don't treat their own cows because they don't have any. But I don't necessarily believe the label, but the industry, the marketing people in the dairy industry have responded with their own voluntary labeling. That's entirely possible. That is what some companies are doing today, like Nestle. They're doing a voluntary labeling. It's a market decision, and the marketing folks figure out what the cost, what the benefit is, and whether it hits their market. And that works for me.
I was going to say, I think that's a really good example. I mean, that product came out, it was massively adopted in the industry, and then it fell away because retailers decided they didn't want to carry it, and certain dairies that had certain markets decided they didn't want to use it. And I know in Sonoma County, where I am, the Clover Storneta Dairy went out and actually met with all its dairymen, and they all had to sign these legal documents to say that they weren't going to use it. And then that kind of took off all around the United States. So yeah. it does show the power of the market. The one thing I would say about the power of the FDA, the problem that we have with the FDA is that many of the people that are in those regulatory positions came from genetic engineering companies, and therefore you've got the public not trusting. So again, we have a problem around perception. Perception. I mean, in politics and in the market, perception drives things. Doesn't even matter what reality is, unfortunately, in many instances. Perception drives things. So when you have government officials who work for private corporations who are making the products that have to get regulated, you have a huge problem. If I was king for a day, I'd say that couldn't happen. Then we could believe our government. But we don't have that situation. We have a much different situation.
No.
And so we're all dealing with that problem. There are no arbiters that the public can believe, whether it's science or the FDA. We have a problem.
Well, I just say, trying to extend that out, the FDA is designed and implemented to be a science-based regulatory system, that you don't make decisions based upon a polling factor or anything else. You base it on science. If you can't hire scientists into the FDA who are experienced in the technology, pardon my French, but how the hell do you make scientific decisions?
Yes.
Yeah, just another question that we talk a lot about distrust.
Uh-huh.
I think it's an interesting thing happening right now, and there's some interesting parallels that can be drawn between distrust of vaccines and distrust of food systems.
Right. I have an idea on that. Actually, it was just mentioned. Historically, universities have been the seat, like this university, have been the seat of places where people turn to arbitrate these questions and find the scientists to answer the question. In the day, back in the day, these institutions were funded by the public, not by corporations. And therefore, that perception problem was alleviated. What's happened in the last 40 years is that as the public has decided not to fund public education, we've turned to corporations for the science to pay for the science. I mean, UC Davis is a big example. A lot of the great science that's being done there is really paid for by corporations. So what happens is you get this lack of belief. That is the problem. So my solution would be, let's go back to a system where the institutions, the universities where the scientists reside and do their great research are in fact publicly funded rather than privately funded. That might go a long way to rebuilding legitimacy.
Well, I'd love to see that too, because I live in the
right
in this system, but I know it's about as likely as snow in July in Phoenix. But I'd say the answer to your question, what are we going to do about it? You guys. I mean, that's what you're here. That's why we're doing this biotech university. We can't do anything about the media. I can't do anything. I'm not in the media. But you will be. That's why you're at this place. It's to get a well-informed media. Just like I was talking about the FDA, how can you have an organization that's going to do scientific regulation if you don't have scientific expertise? That's why I think you folks that are here, besides the things that you're studying in communications, you also have to have significant depth in scientific understanding and not just go and do a Google search on our topic. You're saying that if the labeling, in fact, had the feared impact, that is, people stopped buying it, that would limit farmers. Well, what would happen? It would force the American public to deal with some things. For instance, let's say, in fact, that happened, and people started saying, "I don't want genetically modified organisms." So then, what would happen is the farmers would begin to look for alternative things to grow or different types of seeds. Then there might be a shortage of those seeds for a while because there wouldn't be out there because we already know there's an increasing shortage of non-genetically modified grain crops, grain seed. So then what it would do would lift up the problem. You guys would be covering it. The American people would wake up. They would push on policymakers and change would happen. So I actually believe in human beings. Many people, we are facing some very huge challenges at this point in our history as human beings, between climate change, disease, all the things that are going on in the world, problems with resources. I actually believe that human beings, it's in our genes, we're going to survive. We're going to figure out our way through this thing that we're facing. And part of the way that it happens is that we have information. People make good decisions on the whole over time if they know what's going on. So I am not afraid of those kinds of problems going on. I think it's good for farmers because they're back in contact with people through that kind of challenge. It's happening right now. I mean, I sit on do a lot of this with farmers too. And one of the things that's really exciting to me is that a farmer who might not totally agree with me, we have really great conversations about the fact that people are paying attention to them again. Farmers are heroes. I mean, it is incredible the media coverage that goes on around agriculture and farming. It hasn't been that way for 40 years. So this is actually, it's scary, but it's good. I have faith in what's going to happen. People are not going to let agriculture be lost from this country. They're not.
I think what we're going to do in the interest of time, we're getting close on time. We're going into a break after this, and there'll be some time for one-on-one. Do you have
it isn't a response, but it's just this whole issue of we have to get back to something. When my father was growing corn in Minnesota,
When I was growing up, he was getting maybe 30, 40 bushels an acre. The U.S. average corn production was around 40 bushels per acre in the 40s. We recently had the American Corn Growers here in Phoenix, and they gave a prize to the top producer. It was over 500 bushels per acre. A guy from Georgia, as I recall. Just astonishing. And you can plot from about 1945 to now the increase in yield. Why is it that the cost of our food supply stays low? And our population is growing. The world population is growing and continues to grow. We're getting more from an acre of land today than we ever have. And I think it's true in all the major crops. It's coming because companies, starting with Luther Burbank and going up through DeKalb and Pioneer and all the corn companies going up, have invested money in every available technology to make better crop genotypes. And we're being rewarded. And the farmers are being rewarded with greater profits. The consumer is being rewarded with inexpensive, high-quality, safe food supply. And to somehow say, we got to go back to some basics, I think is just, there's nothing in our society, my little iPhone here, everything is continual technological improvement to the benefit of the consumers, at least in a capitalistic society like we are.
And I agree with him 100%. I don't think I've ever said we got to go back to a different kind of agriculture. We're going forward. The question is, how do we go forward? That's all I'm saying. I've never said that. I don't believe that myself. I believe in the increasing understanding and use of science in agriculture. I think it's absolutely essential. We're not going to survive without it because we have huge challenges. So I agree with that, and I hope that no one has heard me say that we need to go back to the 1940s agriculture. I don't believe I've ever said that.